Hey everybody, welcome to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley and I am joined tonight for a discussion of Fargo by JB.
People say I'm funny looking, you know, just funny looking.
I'm so glad you didn't go with like a you betcha, because I really, before we started, I was like, I'm not going to make any jokes about wacky Minnesota accents.
I wouldn't do that. That would be the work of a hack.
You can find our website at fthismovie.net. And you can like us on Facebook, which you should do at facebook.com/fthismovie. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. And find us in the iTunes store. And if you're listening for the first time or the 150th time and you like our show and you're so inclined, please leave us a positive review in the iTunes store. It helps our show get more attention. The more reviews we get, that are positive, especially the higher it bumps us up and the more visibility it gives us. So,
and I like reading the reviews because it helps me to justify my phony baloney existence.
We're going to be talking about Fargo. It's December already, which is insane. There's only a few weeks left in 2012, which means in just a couple weeks we're going to be doing our annual overrated, underrated, and ugly show.
And there were some ugly things this year.
I think there's some
May
of everything.
May I just tease you with that fact, sir?
I think there's some things that were really underrated. I think there are some things that were really overrated. This year deals with extremes only on that show, because then when I think we get to our top 10 show, which will be the following week, my feelings are less passionate about the top 10.
I have a feeling that the three of us, I'm guessing it's going to be you and I and,
the other one. Good Doug, old Doug. So-and-so. Yes, Doug, that's correct.
That there will be massive
disparity.
No, the opposite.
Oh, you think we're all going to be the same?
And on a lot of things.
Maybe. Maybe. I like it better when we're all different.
I'm just basking in the glow. No, it's not that. That it's December now, and suddenly we get a whole bunch of movies that at least the studio thinks are good. Because lately I've been going to the movies, and maybe I'm still on a Skyfall high. But
that was like 3 weeks ago, though.
Everything I've seen has been better than average,
right,
which
right.
is all but that's you can
kinda,
hope for.
That's kind of the year.
Yeah.
Speaking of everything you've seen lately, have you seen anything good lately?
I did. I'm still on the fence. Again, for a man of my size, it's hard to be on the fence. It hurts. I saw Killing Them Softly, which started life under a different title.
Yes.
And it's the work of a director I admire, whose name I can never remember.
Andrew Dominik.
Who I tend to call Dominik Sena.
Who directed Swordfish.
There you go.
Another movie you admire.
Never. I'd use Doug's joke, but I won't. I'm on the fence about Killing Them Softly. There's a lot to like. There's some sequences that are just unbelievable filmmaking. I'm not sure if it holds together. He's added a very thick political subtext. This sort of underworld tale takes place during the 2008 election and the economic meltdown. And we're constantly being shown election billboards, and every place has a radio on or a TV on. And it's sort of, I think he makes it very explicit at the end why he did that. I'm not sure if that works. I think it's worth seeing. James Gandolfini, very, very interesting. In fact, there's a bunch of people in this who were in The Sopranos, in big parts and small parts. Brad Pitt, of course, is the whole thing. The audience I saw it with last night was not happy. I felt a lot of middle-aged couples who were sort of going for Brad Pitt and crime, and they were not prepared for how just unutterably dark this film is. And at the end, Brad Pitt has this sort of, you could almost call it a monologue, where he's saying something that's pretty hard to swallow, and actually making fun of Obama's acceptance speech that night when he won, and sort of critiquing it, and the audience was not a happy bunch of campers.
All right.
I think it's worth seeing. I think more than one critic has suggested that not only did the Weinstein Company change the title, but they also played around with it, because it does seem like it's been shortened.
I thought I heard stories about that happening to Assassination of Jesse James as well, which is Andrew Dominik's last movie. And if that's the case, then that's like the best possible, that's the best time that's ever happened. Like, it rarely happens that a studio messes with a movie and you still get a masterpiece.
I can't believe that.
I don't know for sure that that's true. I have read that before. Just that it was messed with. I don't know that they took stuff out necessarily, but
the set pieces in Killing Them Softly work a lot better than the whole thing.
Okay.
And you could easily imagine a different assembly or something that was longer. Certainly the pace of the individual scenes doesn't speak to a 97-minute movie.
Right. Okay. Anything besides Killing Them Softly?
Not anything I'm allowed to talk about, because one of them is a big surprise.
I've seen a couple of things that I will talk about, most of them recent, I think. I got to see The Sessions, the John Hawkes, Helen Hunt movie, where he plays a man who's not exactly paralyzed, but he can't move because he had polio when he was very young, and Helen Hunt is his sexual surrogate. I liked it. The performances are great. John Hawkes is obviously great as always. Helen Hunt is very good. Very naked, if you're into that sort of thing. There were just a lot of choices that I wasn't as crazy about. I don't like to label movies awards bait necessarily. There are moments, though, that feel like it's a movie that has been sort of engineered to do that. I think there's a lot of times they could have gone way further with that, and they don't. I mean, it's a pretty light and warm and often funny movie.
Some of the reviews that I read suggested that it was engineered to be a critic's favorite or right. to do well at Sundance, and a lot of critics specifically pointed to William H. Macy's part as being the sort of Greek chorus of Twee.
Yeah, no, that's probably true. I was interested, though, as I was watching it, because, you know, around this time of year, we've commented before to one another that the theater that we go to, especially the morning shows on the weekend, are filled with an adult crowd, usually older adults who are catching up on things that may be nominated for awards or whatever, or make a lot of 10 best lists. And I'd be very curious to see their reaction to this, because I think a lot of them are going to have a really hard time with the graphic sexual stuff.
Did it?
And that's wrong.
Did it get to our theater?
Yes.
Okay, because I've been busy seeing other things.
Yes.
Like Lincoln, by the way, which is terrific.
Yeah. Okay, I still haven't seen Lincoln either.
Yeah, well worth everyone's time.
That and Killing Them Softly are the two that I need to catch up on. I saw a movie called Save the Date, which stars Lizzie Kaplan and Alison Brie, two darlings of the internet. They play sisters. Alison Brie is engaged to be married to Martin Starr, and Lizzie Kaplan is going through some romantic drama. It's sort of a romantic comedy. It's available on demand if you want to see it. It's getting a limited theatrical release in a couple of weeks. Another movie that I liked without loving for about the first hour, I was like, wow, this is actually really different and really good. And it reminded me, the movie it kind of reminded me of was Friends with Kids, not in the way that it, not Friends with Kids.
I was going to say, not in the bad way. Friends with Benefits.
No, Jesus. In my head, it was Friends with Money, but that's not even the right movie. I'm thinking of Please Give. So I was three steps removed. They're not similar in terms of subject matter, but in the way that they approach believable human beings whose problems aren't movie problems, and the way that it sidesteps a lot of cliches. It does that for a while, and then it embraces those cliches.
It's in for the cliche kill. I am a big fan of Lizzie Kaplan.
Yeah.
Really thought she was terrific in Cloverfield, and then she did sort of a three-episode arc on...
We all remember her arc on True Blood.
No, I don't mean for that.
I know.
I thought she was really good. In fact, yeah. It was after she was in Cloverfield that I was trying to find other things that she was in, and I guess in some movies she looks way different.
Yeah.
That she's capable of pulling that off.
Yeah. She has a speech, without giving anything away, in Save the Date, she has this speech to her sister where she talks about, like, you know that I'm, like, a really happy person, right? I'm upset right now, but in general, I'm the happiest person you know. And that's fine, and maybe that's true, but I felt like if we're supposed to believe that, Lizzie Kaplan is not the person you cast to play the happiest person you know.
I could see that. And wasn't she on that catering show?
Party Down.
Yeah.
Which is a great show. Two more. I ended up seeing Battleship, which was a movie I avoided when it was in theaters and caught up with now. And it is, it should be put in a time capsule. It is, it's bad in ways both generic and fascinating. Most of it is horrible just in the way that's like, it's a summer blockbuster that's copying Michael Bay. So what you have is a copy of a copy of a copy. It's based on a board game. It,
I thought the robot villains owed a lot.
Everything about the aesthetic, yeah. Even the color timing. The cast is assembled out of like hot TV stars and a model and Rihanna and it's
and Liam Neeson. Right now he's in everything.
And this is blockbuster filmmaking in quotes in 2012. So it's bad. It's so boring. And there's a long scene where they really are trying to like they can't see the alien ship, so they're trying to bomb it by looking at this grid. I mean, they're basically, for 10 minutes, you're watching them play Battleship.
It's I didn't put that together.
It is remarkably stupid. And then at the end,
that
it
makes
goes,
me want to see it.
Because then at the end, it goes really crazy, and I won't spoil why. And then it gets bad in all new ways. I don't recommend seeing it, because it's not a movie that's bad enough in a way that's entertaining.
You're reminding me of how much I used to like to play Battleship as a kid. In fact, you'd lay on your stomach and play for so long, you'd get the Battleship backache from lying tummy down on the cold concrete of the basement.
Sure.
I think this is pretty specific to me. I can't believe you saw it. You took one for the team, and by team, I mean U.S. Navy.
My God, the amount of fetishizing of the military that goes on in this. The movie just should have ended with Peter Berg just blowing the Army and the Navy and the Air Force, not the Marines. It's terrible.
It's
and
a great place to start.
And you mentioned earlier in the podcast, we talked about Good, Bad, Ugly. You said, yeah, there's a movie that got really ugly, and I know the movie you're talking about. I would put Battleship pretty close.
Really?
It's really pretty bad.
So now I have three reasons to see Battleship. In the next 3 weeks. Is that on cable?
No, it
hasn't hit cable yet?
No, it's on DVD and Blu-ray.
One of my students brought up that we have a remarkably short window, and I know that happens more and more.
Looper is going to be out on DVD by the end of the year.
Here's the example that came up, because I was such a big fan of Paranorman, and a lot of my students were studying the Puritans and the witch hunts and stuff, and I was recommending that they go see Paranorman. And that came out in September. And last week it came out on disc.
It's insane.
So the marketing strategy is, well, we're shooting for Halloween, but we open it a couple weeks before Halloween because we're scared of Frankenweenie and Dark Shadows and Hotel Transylvania at Halloween. And if we open it in September, we then get the Christmas sales if we can have the DVD come out in late November, early December, which I don't mind because I want as many people to see Paranorman as possible. But that's a crazy short window.
Yeah, and you don't have a chance to see things in a theater if they're yanking them that fast. I don't know. The last movie I'll mention that I saw is Zero Dark Thirty, the new movie from Kathryn Bigelow about the hunt for Osama bin Laden.
You went downtown and bought a bootleg copy of that?
Correct.
That someone videotaped
from
off
a nice
screen,
man on the street.
Los Angeles or something? I'm very jealous of the fact that Patrick got to see that, because I'm guessing most of you have seen the trailer. The trailer really makes me want to see it.
It's a great trailer. I think the movie delivers on the trailer. I won't say too much about it. I think it's a really strong movie. I think Kathryn Bigelow is a hell of a director. Very procedural and not necessarily about more than it's about, which is okay, but anybody who's expecting maybe some larger themes may be disappointed if you're just going in for sort of this procedural, and I don't know how accurate it is. I mean, the main character is sort of Jessica Chastain, and I'm guessing she's a construct. I don't think she's based on any one person. But very, very well done and very much worth seeing.
I've always been a big fan of Bigelow. She directed Near Dark, which I wrote about a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And terrific director, specifically a terrific action director, because, of course, I'm such a big fan of Near Dark, I often forget that she directed this other action film that a lot of people seem to like a lot.
And rightly so. We're talking about K-19, The Widowmaker, correct?
She didn't direct that, did she?
Sure she did.
Oh my. Okay. Wow. Patrick's pulling his. He's actually putting his hand into the obscurity bag and pulling it out. I, of course, was referring to Point Break.
Oh, Point Break! That awesome movie. I love Point Break, everyone. Okay, let's talk about Fargo.
Yes, and Fargo is terrific.
Yes.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
We're going to try several ways to not turn this into the Chris Farley show and not just ooze
right.
obsequiousness. One thing I wanted to bring up, besides the fact that Fargo is great, is that for the longest time, I thought the Coen brothers were capable of the highest highs and the lowest lows. And for a really long time, they made these great movies, and then there were these other ones. And then thinking about it this morning, I think they've really evened out their average for the most part. And there used to be a time where I had this theory, I don't know if this is true anymore, that if they seemed to like the characters, the movie was terrific. And if the characters seemed to be on the screen for them to mock them, the movie was less terrific. But I'm not sure if that's true anymore. Although, part of that reason, and we talked about this a couple weeks ago, I've never seen Intolerable Cruelty.
Right.
But I have seen their remake of The Lady Killers.
Yeah.
Which, on paper, a crime involving quirky, eccentric characters, it seems like that movie makes itself, and The Lady Killers is dismal.
I still contend that that's their only truly bad movie. I think they have lesser movies. Intolerable Cruelty is not great by any means, but I think there are things to like in it. Everything else is a step up from that.
And I think we may have had this argument before, but I was drunk. You like Hudsucker.
I do, but I have something to say about that. And maybe we'll get to it. I guess we could talk about it now.
Yes.
Because what I was thinking about when I was watching Fargo is, Fargo came out in 96. And that was a very important time for me to see Fargo. Because in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s, there was the sort of Sundance explosion. And every new filmmaker was hip and quirky. And Quentin Tarantino, of course, was the poster boy for all of that. And Pulp Fiction comes out in 94. And I loved Pulp Fiction then. I love it now. I can't necessarily hold Quentin Tarantino personally responsible, but every movie then became quirky and arch and ironic. And so Fargo comes out, and for the first half hour or so, I'm not accusing the first half hour of Fargo of being arch, but I think I remember sitting in a theater full of people kind of laughing, because there's Steve Buscemi, who's in all the quirky, ironic crime movies, and they have these funny accents, and William H. Macy is kind of a fuck-up, and so we're laughing at him, and there's all these things that we can sort of laugh at kind of ironically. And then Frances McDormand shows up, and she embodies sincerity.
She's the antidote.
In a way that cured me of all of that from the 90s forward, which brings me back to the Hudsucker Proxy. The first time I saw it, I really liked it. I can still watch it and enjoy it, but the older I get, the less tolerance I sort of have for it, because it is just a big sort of air quote of a movie. It's, look at these things we're referencing, look at this wacky style that we're doing. Again, I can still enjoy it on that level, but it is just sort of a hollow approximation of something else.
And there's pieces of it I like.
Yeah.
I just don't think it adds up to anything. And I want to go from what you said about Margie showing up and sort of getting rid of all of that post-Tarantino irony, because I think what was key about the Tarantino wave, and it's important to note that it starts with Reservoir Dogs, which of course is really where Steve Buscemi gets noticed.
Right, and the only reason I pointed to Pulp Fiction was because that was the one that actually put him on people's radar. I mean, guys like us knew Reservoir Dogs, but
okay.
Pulp Fiction plays at the mall, and your parents went to see Pulp Fiction.
But that both films have this very unique, ironic sensibility, and I don't want to say it's an accident, but I think it's interesting that they both deal with crime. So now we're looking at a very young filmmaker doing a very violent film, ironically,
mm-hmm.
and mean, I just saw Reservoir Dogs a couple days ago, and I continue to be very impressed by that film. It's sort of amazing. But in the wake of Tarantino, you see other filmmakers trying irony with violence, and that's a really hard thing to manage.
Right. Violence is funny. Violence is a punchline.
And think about the violence in Fargo. It's pretty extreme. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about the body count by the time we get to the end of it. But I would argue that none of the crime is shown in a funny light. I'm thinking of Buscemi's partner in crime.
Peter Stormare.
Playing a character whose name I still can't pronounce even when I see it on the page. It's really weird. That when he shoots the patrolman and then they go after the two witnesses, that's presented very realistically and very unironically. And I wonder if it's on purpose that Marge is introduced as sort of the antidote to irony. And then at the end, we get what perhaps is the most cartoon-like violence in the film. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing that's your friend there in the wood chipper.
Right. I remember going to see Fargo when it came out in 96. I had to go to a theater in the city because sometimes movies will play at sort of the art theaters downtown, and then if they do well, they open wide. So it eventually did open
wide. I always thought they don't open wide till we haul our ass downtown to see them, and then once we see them, Baudelaire's seen it? Okay, release the Kraken.
And I think I've told this story before because Mike had this on his list of his favorite movies that we did around this time last year. I went to see it and I remember not knowing anything about it, but I had read Roger Ebert's review where very early in the review, he says, this is one of the best movies I've ever seen. And I've never heard him talk that way about a movie that had just come out. So I was pretty stoked to see it and I saw it and I loved it and it ends and all of the sort of Lakeshore yuppies in the theater stand up and they all hated it. And they're all very vocally, which always bothers me too when people have to announce their opinion of a movie seconds after it's ended. That was so stupid. That was one of the worst movies I've ever seen. And next to me is this woman who's maybe 75 years old by herself in this enormous fur coat. And she turns to me and says, "What did you think?" I said, "I loved it." She said, "It was just so beautifully done." And that was the difference that I had. This person next to me who, thank God, loved it because the rest of the theater turned on it.
Well, if these North Shore yuppies are hipsters, which we've talked about before, and they're going to see something very specific, I remember, and I love the film Blue Velvet, but I remember seeing Blue Velvet at the late lamented Fine Arts Theater the weekend it opened, and man, was I stoked to see it. And that film could not have had a better audience because they started laughing from the slow motion fireman who waves as the, isn't it funny that someone could have an idyllic small town existence? Show us a white picket fence next, David. We're with you. So I think it's interesting that you see it with this audience and they hate it and they're walking out and they're grumbling about, what did they say? That it was
the stupidest movie
that it was seen. The stupidest movie ever, because seeing it again for the podcast, I was struck, and I think I'm continually struck because I've seen this movie a bunch of times, with how simple and how beautiful and how sweet the last line of this film.
Not to out myself as a bit of a Nancy, but that last scene makes me cry almost every time I watch it.
And what an amazing relationship she has with her husband and how she's effortlessly able to make him feel better about being on the 3-cent stamp because people keep those around. But again, when you say that when the Marge character enters, irony is swept away, 2 more months and all that implies. And that's why they didn't like it.
Yeah.
Because, and I've said this hundreds of times at school, some people are tragically hip and they do not want to believe that romantic love is possible or that life can be an adventure. And I think all of us on F This Movie, we believe that romantic love is possible and that life can be an adventure. But let me tell you, some people reject this notion like a bad kidney. And I think that's what those hipsters were doing
perhaps
at the screening that you saw.
Perhaps.
I would argue that it's sweet, and yet it earns its sweetness. And, it's something just occurred to me. Because watching Fargo, I was comparing it mentally to Raising Arizona.
Okay.
because both films revolve around a kidnapping. And I began to think about how many of the Coen brothers revolve, how many of their films revolve around a kidnapping, which I want to talk about in a second. But at the end, Nicolas Cage and his wife do the right thing, and he has a dream. And I will now out myself as a Nancy. It's the silliest thing you've ever seen. I think it might be the music, but he pictures a future that's very touching. Mm-hmm. And in terms of Raising Arizona, that's an even bigger title shift for that film, because that film has been monumentally silly for most of its running time.
Yeah, not that I dislike what's come before, but that is the scene that sort of redeems all of Raising Arizona for me. Not that I, like I said, not that I dislike it, but to me, it would be sort of disposable, almost in the way that Hudsucker is disposable.
And I might have a different relationship with Raising Arizona, because for years I've shown it in class as an example of comedy. That's the last comedy film in the comedy unit. And I would argue the film earns our respect before Nicolas Cage's dream, when they go back, spoiler alert, when they go to put the baby back, and they're talking to Nathan Arizona, and he figures out what's going on.
Yeah.
And he says, I don't know much, but I know people. And he gives them some advice. And this character who's been ridiculous, Trey Wilson is this ridiculous, sputtering, nonsensical fool. He says, I hate to think of my wife leaving me. And it sort of catches in his throat. And he says, I do love her so. It's like, this is the same movie? And I would argue the Coen brothers get better at it.
Yeah.
In Fargo.
Yeah.
Because as you pointed out, there's some very silly things at the beginning of this.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Tone shift.
Tone
discuss.
Shift. Fargo is still my favorite of the Coen brothers movies. And probably a movie, you know, again, depending on, we've done our favorite movies, we did a few extra favorite movies. I've never included Fargo just for whatever, because I felt it like it was already represented or whatever. If you're somebody who loves movies, you probably have more than three favorite movies. So I have a bunch. Fargo's one of them.
And it was months ago, or maybe it was years ago, because I've lost all track of time. There was a night, or maybe an afternoon, where we were in your basement screening room.
Yeah.
And
that was the first movie we watched there.
And was it chosen at random? Or
kind of.
We kind of
Erica had never seen it.
We kind of got together and was like, what should we watch?
Yeah.
Which never happens.
No.
Because you're the DJ. I'm the rapper. You're the DJ. And I remember that screening really well, because I've always loved the film, but we watched it, and all four of us, all six of us, were like, my God, with the passing of time, it just gets better. It's terrific, and if you have basic cable, AMC is showing it to death this month, with that game where you don't show any commercials for the first 20 minutes, and you get people hooked. And literally, by the end, they're showing commercials every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But you can avoid AMC, because I noticed something. Those of you who frequent Amazon.com, they've been having all these DVD and Blu-ray deals for the holidays. They have the Coen Brothers Blu-ray box, which, hold on, as I move my chair.
It's Blood Simple, Fargo, Raising Arizona,
Miller's Crossing.
And Miller's Crossing.
It's those four.
Yeah.
It's those four films on Blu-ray, $20.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring this up during the podcast. That's a deal.
Yeah. $5 each for those movies.
And you won't throw any of them
across.
Not
a loser in the bunch.
No,
yeah.
Not a loser in the bunch.
Yeah.
So my question was,
yes.
Why are the Coen brothers obsessed with kidnapping? I started to sort of go through their films, and it's been a while since I've seen Blood Simple. Is that a kidnapping gone wrong, or is that just a murder?
It's a murder.
Okay, so I'm wrong. Raising Arizona, kidnapping. Fargo, kidnapping. Big Lebowski, kidnapping. And certainly a lot of their films revolve around crime.
Yes.
I wonder why.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Oh, well then the podcast is over, because on this notepad in front of me,
why do their films revolve around crime?
Ask Patrick about the kidnapping. That's all I got.
I couldn't say specifically kidnapping. I mean, why do their films revolve around crime? Why do... I mean, because they like to sort of deal with extremes, because it presents an opportunity to tell specific kinds of stories with specific tools that they're very good at, which is sort of a juxtaposition of violence and comedy, and they can have these colorful characters that they could go super extreme like Raising Arizona, or they can kind of dial it back, and, you know, No Country for Old Men is a pretty humorless movie, and yet you have this extremely quirky character like Anton Sugar, but it's presented very matter-of-factly.
And you could easily see them presenting that as comedy in a different film.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you brought that up, because you said Fargo is hands down your favorite Coen Brothers film. I have to say, I like them so much that I think it's a tie. I think it's a tie for third place, tie for first place. I love Fargo, maybe because I've seen it so many damn times and stood in the back of the classroom and softly wept during Nicolas Cage's monologue. Raising Arizona's right up there. But, oh, brother, where art thou? I don't think it gets any better than that. It is just so good for so many different reasons. And because it's so episodic, they have more space for their little repertory company, and I like when they show up. And also, Old Country for No Men. It's such an old country, there are no men. It's just a country of women. Old Country, No Country. No Country for Old Men. No Country, I got it right that time.
Yeah,
No
did.
Country for Old Men. You were here. I was so happy when that got the Oscar.
I remember.
It was like, my God, they got it right once in 30 years.
Yeah.
And that was the year everyone disagreed with me because people were in different camps.
Yeah, I don't even remember.
That No Country stole it from There Will Be Blood.
Yeah, whatever.
A film I have big problems with.
Sure. No Country for Old Men, not to get talking about that movie too much, that's a movie that I think is great, but that I end up admiring more than I end up loving. And that is partially just a matter of tone. It is a movie that is hard to warm to by design.
Yeah, it's
it doesn't have a Marge Gunderson at its center.
Speaking of Marge Gunderson,
yes.
I have another question for
yes.
you. Because before, I was lying for humorous intent when I said my list of things on this simple pad of paper was exhausted. I wanted to talk to you about one of the subplots in Fargo.
Okay.
A subplot I've always had a big problem with.
Okay.
And I'm trying to justify it structurally, because if anything, the Coen brothers really structure their scripts very, very well. Marge has to travel for business to investigate the crime or interview someone. And she winds up hooking up again with someone from high school. He is a sad Asian stalker. Although when they meet, we don't know that yet. We find that out later. Every time I see the movie, I think, why is this in the film?
I wish I had my own personal answer, but I'll give you what Roger Ebert has said, because this would come up a lot when he used to do his Answer Man, when Fargo was playing, and then again, kind of when it started making the rounds on video and a lot of people were seeing it for the first time, lots of people asked that same question, because you have this movie, and then it stops for this scene with this guy. His theory is not so much what happens in that scene, although, you know, I guess it just sort of reinforces how nice she is and reaffirms her relationship with her husband and whatever, is that the next morning when she talks to a friend and the friend says, oh no, his wife's alive or whatever, why would he say that, or right? Do I have that right? That's the moment where it occurs to Marge that William H. Macy was lying. She's in the car afterwards. She stops and gets some fast food, which is a moment that I love. And her expression changes so slightly. And then the very next scene, she goes back to William H. Macy to confront him again.
Right.
That.
And that's the great scene. He's fleeing the interview.
Yeah. Which, I mean, it's never presented. You know, one of the things that I love so much about Marge is that she's a great cop. And it's not by accident, and she doesn't stumble onto things. Like, she does good police work, and she's really good at her job. So it's not as though she's presented as a character who can't conceive of a world in which characters lie before that moment, because we know that she's encountered criminals before who have lied, but that is sort of the catalyst for her going back to talk to William H. Macy.
I think you might be right, because for the longest time, and in terms of the structure of the script, in terms of the through line, that does make sense. For the longest time, I thought they put it in there because they were very entertained by an Asian man speaking with that accent. Speaking of the accent, I found out in my canoodling today that the film had some dialect coaches to help actors get the weird Minnesota thing down, and I read they used audio tapes of the accent to try and teach it. And I'm not sure which one it is, but one of them was cast as one of the two prostitutes.
Oh yeah.
So one of the two prostitutes, and you have to admit both of them have that voice nailed. It's called Minnesota Nice.
You were having sex with the little fella.
That one of those two prostitutes was the dialect coach who taught the other people how to.
I'm always fascinated by them, and I'm not here to judge their physical appearance, but when they show up on camera, they don't look like people who are in movies ever. They don't look like people who are cast because they are unusual looking, the way that a lot of movies will do, nor do they look like glamorous movie stars. They just look so normal.
And I always assume that the Coen brothers did that on purpose because those two seem to have a very fascinating backstory that they don't do this a lot,
right?
But they do sometimes.
And the thing about the accents, and that's, you know, one of the things that everyone sort of took away. Sorry, I just kicked the skeleton at the table. That's not a euphemism. That the two things that people took away from Fargo were the wood chipper and the accents. And that's what everybody remembers about that movie. And that's what they reference when you bring up Fargo. Everybody will start going, oh yeah, you betcha, haha, and they pat themselves on the back. Yeah, the accents are definitely played for laughs at times because you have entire exchanges where characters are just going, yeah, yeah, oh yeah, like, and it's funny, and it's supposed to be funny. And the reason that they get away with it, the Coen brothers, is because I don't think that even though those moments are funny, the movie is never, I don't think, mocking any of those characters.
No.
The movie loves those characters so much.
And there's a scene I love, and every time I see the movie, it's one of those things where you can never quite remember where it fits, and then it comes on the screen. A rather tall gentleman has called the cops because he wants to report something. His wife has told him, you need to call this in. And he's talking to the cop, and that scene is accent.
Is this the thing out in the street?
Yes.
He's like shoveling or whatever? He's salting?
He has a broom.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's brooming slush yeah. into the thing. And the scene goes on for a pretty long time, but, you know, referencing what we've been talking about all night about irony, there was this thing that happened that struck him as wrong. And he did the right thing.
Yeah.
He called it in.
Yeah.
And it turns out that it's an important clue
right.
to the case.
Right.
And that's another actor who doesn't seem to be an actor.
It seems like somebody they cast from the area.
He's really tall, and we love the way he talks. Yeah. But it's a great scene, and I'd have to watch it again. It might be one take.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
Shoot. Yeah, again, I don't think that the movie tries to play up this angle of these people are so nice, and they don't even know what to do with notions of crime and violence.
Oh, no, no, no.
Their world is rocked by this.
No,
it doesn't try and play that game.
They're well aware
yeah.
because the film is actually, and this might be another thing your Tragically Hip audience hated, they're well aware of it, and because they're so aware of it, they choose to live a life that's as far as that
right.
from possible.
Right.
Getting back to Marge, you mentioned Marge and the fact that the wood chipper scene is so famous. Marge is really good at her job. That's one of the joys of watching this film, seeing someone who's really... You recently reviewed Columbo for DVD Verdict, and that's one of the pleasures of that show, that he's so... And just to see the wheels turning, that when Marge finally confronts him at the wood chipper, she has obviously trained in how to do this, but it's obvious she's scared stiff.
Sure.
I mean, it's
yeah.
it's fraught with danger, but the incredible intelligence... Because the wood chipper's so loud that Stormari can't even hear her, that when she does get his attention,
she points to the
badge. She knows to point to the badge on her hat. That's such yeah. a beautiful moment.
I love it. I love it. And again,
and when he runs, she nails him.
Yeah.
And that's not a close distance. It's like, oh, she's a marksman too.
And I love that her disgust isn't necessarily at the scene at the wood chipper. It's not till in the car ride later, and she has that great speech where she says, and all over a little bit of money.
Oh.
And it's so, the way that it puts the whole movie into perspective.
It's It's beautiful.
It's so great. I love that too. Now it's turning into the Chris Farley Show.
Okay, we're gonna take a left turn from the Chris Farley Show. I wanted to talk a little bit about how wonderful. I used to think about this. I used to think this about Coppola in the 60s and 70s and 80s. That Coppola had such an eye for talent that his casting was just wow. It's amazing. And if you look at the Coen brothers' body of work, certainly there's some actors that they like using again and again and again. Mm-hmm. They have a hard on for John Goodman, like nobody's business.
He's always great in their stuff.
He's always great in their stuff. That for a while I thought that this was Buscemi's breakout role, but it wasn't. That was Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
And then for some reason he plays Buddy Holly the waiter in Pulp Fiction almost as a joke. His character in From Dusk to Dawn is named Buscemi because Rodriguez had such an amount of respect for him and was now casting him in the part that would normally be played by someone. That the joke was, I'm giving you the Buscemi part because you're Buscemi. But certainly Buscemi is amazing in this, and it was fairly early in his career. And you see William H. Macy, who, has he ever given a bad performance?
No, but this was, unless you were a David Mamet fan.
I was just going to say.
This is when William H. Macy pops up on everybody's radar, and I feel like, I know I did, I have to assume everybody else did, watch that movie, and you say, who was that? Like, oh my God, is he good?
And again, going back to what you said about the sort of the arch irony turning into something different. The scene where the cops at the end pop into the hotel and arrest him, it amazes me how long the Coen brothers dwell on his absolute mewling, screaming. Yeah. It's like a child. It's like an animal. He's done. It's so hard to watch.
Right, and yet there's something that's much more satisfying about that than if so many other movies, it would have been a shootout, and Jerry Lundegaard would have been shot and killed by Marge, and I guess our bloodlust sated, we would all be cheering. But they're right. What his fate is so much more satisfying than any stupid shootout or something would have been.
And is another example where something, I mean, I would argue that he's one of the more comic characters at the beginning of the film.
Sure.
That they're able to just completely twist it and make it something else. I was thinking about the Coens' whole body of work and how excellent they are at casting. And my mind drifted to A Serious Man.
Okay.
That was so good. Didn't we all go see that together?
No.
I always think you were there because it was a larger group and we went to this really uncomfortable art house by our home. You know the theater I'm talking about.
I do.
And one of the rare instances where the movie's so good, you don't know what to think of it right when it's over. You sort of have to carry it around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I had the same reaction to Synecdoche, New York when I first saw it at Ebertfest. I couldn't process it. And then a couple weeks went by and I saw it on cable. I saw it for a second time and I was like, holy shit. So I saw Serious Man, couldn't wrap my head around it. A couple weeks, months later, it comes out on Blu-ray and I watch it again. I could see why some people have a problem with that film.
Yeah.
It's a masterpiece. It's amazingly good.
Yeah.
And I'm watching it, and the protagonist, who's on screen practically the entire time, is Michael Stuhlbarg. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah.
And talk about an eye for talent, because this is what I was looking up before. Stuhlbarg appears in A Serious Man, and suddenly, he's everywhere.
Yeah.
Is there any film he's not in, or, I looked him up on the IMDb's, I think he's just in things I watch.
Perhaps.
So, I'm guessing that was his big break, because before that he just did a lot of TV and stuff. After A Serious Man, he gets cast on Boardwalk Empire as Arnold Rothstein. And in the last 2 or 3 years, he's been in Hugo, Men in Black 3, Seven Psychopaths, Lincoln, and Hitchcock.
Wow. I remember him from Men in Black 3, and I remember he does kind of a cameo in Seven Psychopaths.
Yeah.
And I think when I saw Hugo, I didn't even realize it was him until the end credits. But he's great.
Yeah.
But the fact that they didn't really, I think Michael Lerner was like the biggest celebrity that they cast in A Serious Man, right? Isn't Michael Lerner in that? He might not even be. Maybe I have that wrong.
I'm remembering Michael Lerner as in Barton Fink.
He's maybe that's what I'm doing. A Serious Man didn't really have any stars. A hard movie to market.
I don't know how you can market it. I mean, look at the poster. It's a guy on a roof with a TV antenna.
But that was their follow-up to Oh, it wasn't their follow-up. I always think it was their follow-up to No Country for Old Men, but I think the other one was in between. Brad Pitt with the Pompadour and George Clooney. Burn After Reading. Was actually...
Because for the longest time, I had that stupid theory that they would make one fantastically popular film for the studio, and then they'd make one for themselves, which, and we know they have a weird sense of humor about a lot of things, that they would sort of make this quirky thing that, in the words of, where's my brain? It's late, ladies and gentlemen. In the words of Danny DeVito in Man on the Moon, something else they've been showing on cable a lot this month, you've made a joke that's only funny to two people right. in the universe,
right.
the two Coen brothers.
I'm kind of a fan of Burn After Reading, though.
No, I think there's things in that film to like, but again, it's like, this sounds like such a cliche, it's like they're not swinging for a home run on that one.
No.
That it's this but little thing.
I think it's
thing
okay to not always swing for a home run.
No.
And I think,
see you've never been a Little League coach.
Absolutely not. And I think it's interesting in the way that it subverts almost everything we go to the movies for and the way that it...
Well, you have a warm spot in your heart for films that subvert everything we go to the movies for. I've long said that Eraserhead is the king of...
Sure.
Is this why you go to the movies? I'm going to give you this.
But Eraserhead doesn't cast George Clooney and Brad Pitt to get people out to the multiplex and then trick them into seeing Burn After Reading, the movie that ends with this conversation where, spoilers for Burn After Reading, it ends with just them saying, like, I don't know what the fuck happened. It's the greatest last scene.
I was going to say that in a very strange way, what you just described is what Killing Them Softly has done.
Okay.
Lured middle-aged moviegoers to the multiplex to see Brad Pitt. Brad's got something up his sleeve. Brad doesn't want you to like his movies. Witness Tree of Life.
Do you have a favorite movie character of all time? And is it Frankenstein? Is it a monster?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. Earlier you had referenced the Ebert quote, everything now with the passage of time, everything you read about Fargo includes the Ebert quote, because I think...
This is one of the best movies I've ever seen.
He put that in his original review.
Yeah.
He called it his favorite movie of that year. And then a little bit later, maybe when he did his great movies essay on Fargo, he said, Fargo is so good, it reminds me of why I go to the movies. And that's sort of been the quote that everyone's using. What is your favorite movie character, Patrick?
I think it's Marge Gunderson. If I had to pick one, the more times I see Fargo, the more I just love every second that she's on screen. And I love everything about her.
And there's another rare example of the Academy getting it right. She won the Academy Award. My God, how could she not? Fargo won Best Screenplay, which I thought it deserved, and Best Actress. The year that Fargo came out, I've never been able to memorize the Academy Awards. I think months and months, maybe even years ago, I did a fantasy Oscars where for every year, boy, that column took a little bit of time to put together. I sat down and I was like, what was I thinking? They've been giving these things out for 80 years. What was I thinking? Plus, you know, when I'm talking about the 20s, I could just make shit up. In 1928, the Academy handed the award to The Incredible Hamburger Disaster. Well, I don't know. JB says he's been teaching film for a long time. That must have been the film. what won the Oscar the year Fargo was?
If I had to guess, if this was at a point when the Oscars still mattered to me, if I'm trying to remember my rage, I'm going to say The English Patient.
Oh, wow.
I might be wrong, but I think I'm right.
Because I had successfully avoided The English Patient, and then I watched it to write a Shitting on the Classics column about it. And
did you feel like people were trying to trick you for years? That it was this weird prank that everyone had?
I don't understand how I made this joke several times because I fell in love with this joke, and I think I wound up using it five times. that the studio released some chemical
right
into the ventilation system right of the theater to, like, drug you.
It happens every year around the Oscars, and it's why more and more I put no stock in the Oscars. But I don't think you could – I take it back. I said on last week's show you could find a lot of people that genuinely like Jingle All the Way. And a bunch of people chimed in on the comments like, I like Jingle All the Way. But they all admit to liking it for being garbage. I don't think you can find anybody that genuinely likes The English Patient now.
I don't see how that film ever could have cast a spell. I really don't. Either. Because that's, of course, the only reason why that would have happened, because it cast right that month-long bubble of a spell.
Which happens.
That the minute they announce the award, pop! Right. And for the rest of eternity, people say...
The artist. I mean, that was this year's spell.
And the one I was going to use was The Greatest Show on Earth. Oh, sure. My God.
Sure.
Okay, we've now run far afield. Back to Fargo.
Yes.
Something else I noticed while canoodling on the internets, which, as I understand it, is a series of tubes. I can't believe
you didn't say we're too far gone.
I'm not a hack. I'm a lot of things, but I'm not a hack. I would like to be the first podcaster to suggest the following.
All right.
I have assembled some facts, and I'm now going to interpret them in a unique way. On Wikipedia, there's a list of the locations they use.
Okay.
In case you love Fargo so much, you want to visit the locations. And considering that it wasn't made that long ago, I thought it was interesting that most of the main locations have since been razed. R-A-Z-E-D. And I would like to suggest there is a Fargo curse. I am now officially calling it the Fargo curse.
Okay.
The Four Aces Club or whatever the bar is, that's been razed. The car dealership that they used for Lundergaard's place of business, that's been razed. And, again, go on Wikipedia. It's very interesting that what they replaced it with is very generic and dull. And
a Chili's.
No, even worse. It's like, it's
Excuse me. There's nothing worse than Chili's.
No, I do have something worse than Chili's.
Applebee's.
Wait, there's one place where it's impossible to have fun or get good food. Applebee's is awful. Applebee's is the seventh level of hell. Yeah. Chili's is not bad.
All right. I was just joking.
When you go to Chili's, have a bunch of drinks, and then the food is better.
Chili's is fine.
Like, they knocked this down and built a parking lot. But I do remember one of them. I think it's the car dealership. One of the locations of Fargo was razed. It is now the nation's headquarters for Best Buy.
Wow. Awesome. I look forward to that going out of business as well.
They're hurting.
We're so far off topic from Fargo, but a friend of ours posted on Facebook. It was the outside of a Best Buy, but somebody had doctored the logo. So instead of saying Best Buy on the sign, it said Amazon Showroom, which is totally true.
That's the exact joke I've been making because obviously I'm a big Amazon user interface person. And what a wonderful trick Jeff Bezos pulled off. I'm going to turn every store into a showroom for me.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Fargo has one of my favorite scores of all time. It starts immediately when the company, it says MGM and then PolyGram, and then you're just in darkness, and the score starts, and I am immediately completely in love with Fargo. And then it opens on this shot where it's just, you can't see anything. It's pure white. And slowly you start to realize it's snow. And then off in the distance, this car is coming up. One of my favorite opening shots of all time. And I love the way that even that opening shot, in a way, is kind of not a metaphor for the movie, because I think that's a reach. But
and the music in this film was done by Carter Burwell,
yes,
who has done all of their scores but one.
Okay.
And I'm guessing that was Oh Brother Where Art Thou, because it had so much
maybe
special music, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
But Carter Burwell is amazing. I know the soundtrack to Fargo was released, but because Fargo has so much popular music, like playing in the bar and stuff, it was released on a CD with music from another Coen Brothers film. It's like the score to Fargo, and as a bonus, you get this other film. But I have been in love with Carter Burwell ever since the first time I saw Raising Arizona. And there's a theme that runs through that film. It's played on a banjo. And, in fact, it's the score for the amazing chase scene in the middle of the film. That's a little film schooly, but, God, I love that chase. It's just the greatest thing ever. And it took me forever, and I might not have gotten it until the end credits, because in the end credits it goes on forever, and then someone whistles it. It's Beethoven's Ode to Joy, played on a banjo. But because it's a banjo,
right,
you're like, this is rollicking good fun at a pizza parlor named Shakey's. But in the back of your lizard brain, you're like, I've heard this tune before. And I don't think it's till the end credits. The end credits, it goes on forever. And there's humming and whistling. And on the one that's during the chase scene, someone yodels. And the yodeling throws you off. Mm-hmm. Because yodeling and Beethoven don't quite go together either. If you've never seen Fargo, in my mind, you are stinky. You are a stinky person made of poo. And you alone are the only person who can change that by seeing Fargo.
Because Fargo was like maybe their first genuine box office hit. It gets nominated for Oscars. It wins a couple. I feel like Fargo was finally the movie that kind of made the Coen brothers a household name.
That clearly Blood Simple made them a critic's darling, because right, there's a lot to like in Blood Simple.
Oh my gosh, Blood Simple's great. And then Big Lebowski comes out, and people don't know what to make of it, and it's not a big hit, and it doesn't become sort of this cult movie until later.
And there I would lump Big Lebowski with A Serious Man and also Synecdoche, New York, even though it's a different filmmaker. Yeah. Big Lebowski, and you've done a podcast on it, and you can go back and listen to that because it's really good. Big Lebowski is so full of so many things, I think it's another case where it's impossible to process when you're actually watching it.
My problem with the Big Lebowski was that I was coming off of Fargo, and maybe I was expecting that, and I just felt like, oh, it's so sort of shaggy and aimless, and I get that that's sort of the point, but it didn't really satisfy me. And of course, the more times I see Big Lebowski, the more I'm like, oh my god, that movie's a masterpiece.
And because it's shaggy and aimless, it cleverly hides its roots.
Yes.
Because I think I've talked about this before, and Christmas is coming, so
buy us presents.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't going there at all.
Oh, I was.
I'm not expecting.
thismoviepodcast@gmail.com.
That people who listen email would send presents. Us stuff?
Yeah.
Because years ago I asked for an action figure.
Yeah, it didn't happen. I've never asked for anything, so I'm asking for presents.
Here's my point. If you have a film lover on your gift list, like let's say Hollywood Heath Holland's wife is listening to this.
Yes.
This might be a good present. The British Film Institute puts out these little books. They're called monographs, and each one is devoted to a single film, and they're written by people who really know what they're talking about. I'd really like to see the editorial process for who gets picked to do these books, because they're aces, and they're about $10 a piece, and you should buy them all. The BFI monograph on Big Lebowski is amazing, because it looks the film solely at what it does to the sort of James M. Cain mystery story. And because the film is so big and so funny and so full of stuff, it never even occurred to me that at its heart, it's really a Humphrey Bogart film on pot.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I read the monograph where I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
Why didn't I see that? Because it's got all the trappings.
Right. And there's characters that you can point to as this guy's this guy and this guy's this guy.
That they've so successfully, right. You know, it's almost like when you discover that Oh Brother, Where Art Thou was based on the Odyssey,
yeah,
that sort of spins your head around.
Yeah. I love Fargo. I don't know really what else to say. I love it. I think it's a perfect movie, and I don't say that lightly because I end up quoting Devin Faraci way too often, but I think he's a really good writer. He has said before, just because something's a perfect movie doesn't mean it's a flawless movie. So I don't think there's such a thing as a flawless movie, but I do think there are perfect movies. There's only a handful that I can think of. I think Fargo is one of them.
So here's an idea, because on the weekend weigh-in, just 2 days ago, you had asked people what they watch at the holidays.
Yeah.
And of course, some people are stuck watching this dreck because they've watched it every year. How about this? New holiday tradition. Fargo. It's got lots of snow.
Sure.
You could, you know, it's yeah. got some homicide too, but so does Die Hard.
So does Christmas. Oh, sorry.
What? Not around my tree.
You celebrate differently.
They're not really around different. My tree. I don't know what your religion is, young man. Let's make Fargo a new holiday tradition.
I like it. I like it. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next week with our Christmas present to all of you.
Oh, it's going to be something.
It's reindeer games.